I feel like all our decisions about risk are set in a very different context at the moment. COVID-19 and the way it's affecting our communities and changing every detail of our lives that we've taken for granted. That makes me feel that risk decisions feel different now, walking around Sainsbury's or any other large supermarket would involve a risk that wasn't there a month ago.
Taking a risk may be something that Lydia, who is from Oxford, feels very differently about at the moment. But many might still consider what she's about to do to be very risky, because she is one of just a handful of people in the world who has volunteered to take part in a trial of a coronavirus vaccine.
I was sitting at home on my sofa with my family, scrolling through Twitter, and I saw the invitation for people to participate in the study. And I just read it out to my family. I have two teenage children and a husband. My first instinct was that I'd like to put myself forward, and did any of them mind? It was a really quick decision.
If she passes the screening process, she and a group of others, aged from 18 to 55, will become the first people to test this potential new vaccine.
This feels like a really small, very well-managed risk, which is tiny in comparison to the risks that frontline NHS and social care staff are taking every day.
Last week, cases of coronavirus doubled to over a million. Now scientists in labs around the world are relying on volunteers like Lydia in a race against time to develop a drug that could get us out of this crisis.
So it feels like it would be an honour to be able to participate in a really small way in this study that could be so important for the whole community.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, the hunt for a coronavirus vaccine.
In one part of Cambridge University, in a stately red brick building, is a lab that does pioneering work on vaccines. Vaccines in particular for diseases that have come to humans from animals. And this is the lab where one of the coronavirus vaccine candidates might be born.
Samanth Subramanian is a writer for The Guardian. He's been speaking to a man at the forefront of developing a coronavirus vaccine. And he's seen inside that lab in Cambridge.
It has all this equipment that is used for the development of vaccines. So there's what you might call a cell sorter, which sorts four different kinds of cells as they flow past through the machine at 10,000 cells per second. There's a particular facility called Containment Lab 3. It's the highest but one level of biosafety security. And that's where biologists investigate germs like the West Nile virus or the TB bacterium. This lab is so secure that it's nearly hermetic. The joints along all the walls and the floors and the ceilings, they're all sealed tight and sealed again. The steel panels in the walls, they have to be of the type used in the nuclear industry. These are the facilities in which Dr. Jonathan Heaney, who's an immunologist here in Cambridge, these are the spaces in which he works.
So I'm Jonathan Heaney. I study infections that jump from animals to humans. In fact, the large majority of human infections have their origins from animals.
And you spoke to him several times. What's he like?
Jonathan Heaney is a Canadian, I guess, pathologist is what you would accurately call him. He's a tall guy with a shock of white hair. He initially started off as a veterinarian, and then he came into pathology and started studying diseases that come to humans from animals.
What we have as an example of this epidemic is a virus that has come from bats, possibly been amplified in markets in China. The current evidence is that it took residence in pangolins for a short period of time, and then, of course, adapted in such a way that it easily made the jump to humans.
And a couple of the families of viruses that he's been working on, one of these families includes a universal flu vaccine that might work against every single kind of flu that we encounter. And so in January, when the genome of the coronavirus was sequenced and released, he thought we might be able to do this for the coronaviruses as well.
The difference between flu is, of course, we have natural herd immunity. It's known to us. We have vaccines for it. And of course, we're trying to make vaccines against pandemic flu. We don't have any historical immunity in the human population. So this virus is just galloping through populations around the globe like there's no tomorrow.
The first stage of his work really was when the RNA sequence of the virus was released online. Chinese scientists had figured out what the gene sequence was within this virus, and they'd published it open access on the internet.
The coronavirus is made of a type of genetic material called RNA, but scientists convert it to the more recognizable DNA to make it easier to study. By January 13th, less than a week after it was identified, scientists in Shanghai had mapped out the entire genetic sequence of a virus sample collected from a patient.
It's a starting gun for scientists around the world like Heaney to get to work, because the genome really tells you everything you need to know about this virus, how it behaves, what its structural sort of physics is, what its weak points might be. You know, all of this is encoded in the genome. And so really the first item of action for Heaney and for other scientists like him is to, quote unquote, read the genome and see what it tells you.
So is he now working solely on developing a vaccine against COVID-19?
Well, the vaccine that he wants to develop is something that might potentially work against this COVID-19 disease, might also work against SARS. Decades and decades after we've had sort of familiarity with influenza, we have still struggled to develop a universal flu vaccine. So a universal corona vaccine is, again, sort of an ambitious project.
And what stage is he at with this at the moment?
So much of the work is done on computer these days. So by the time the first or second week of February rolled around, and this is barely 4 weeks after the virus's RNA sequence was published, the team had a vaccine candidate that they were ready to start testing in mice. And that's the stage that he's in right now.
Why do you think we see developing a vaccine as being the solution to situations like the one we're in right now?
Vaccines definitely grab the popular imagination because they seem to promise this kind of silver bullet against a disease, you know, and a moment's pinprick in exchange for a lifetime of immunity. And that seems to be the grand bargain of medicine.
Since their mass introduction following World War II, vaccines have saved millions of lives.
Vaccines have been one of the greatest public health success stories the world has seen. And, you know, after clean water, vaccines have saved more lives over the last century than any other intervention.
And there's no doubt that humanity has benefited immeasurably from vaccines and immunizations over the last couple of centuries. And so arguably that is what the imagination holds on to. But from a more scientific point of view, there's like a very practical reason as to why vaccines must figure in mankind's sort of ongoing campaign to battle this particular coronavirus disease. And that is that we don't as yet know whether, once we develop immunity to the coronavirus, how long it lasts, whether it lasts for a couple of years before you get it again. And so you want at some point a weapon against the coronavirus to make sure that you wouldn't have to redevelop this immunity over and over, that these massive flare-ups of disease that we're experiencing right now don't recur in the future.
Within 24 hours, most babies born in the U.S. get their first vaccination for hepatitis B. Over the next 2 years, that infant will receive more than 24 vaccinations to protect them against everything from measles, mumps, and rubella to the flu.
How do vaccines actually work?
So the premise is still that you let into your system some recognizable form of a bacteria or a virus to which your immune system responds. We knew centuries ago that the Chinese were grinding up smallpox sores and blowing them up the nose of healthy children to make sure that they get a mild version of the disease but not a full-blown version to kill them. It has to be just enough that the immune system recognizes it and starts to generate the kind of antibodies that will give you lasting immunity. And very early in the game, this was done by weakening the germ itself, by culturing it again and again until it just caused a mild version of the disease. And that was done throughout much of the 20th century. And then in the 1990s, as genetic technology improved, we began to recognize gradually that you don't even need to introduce a part of the germ. What you really need to introduce into the body is a section of the germ's genetic sequence.
Those types of vaccines where a person could be injected not with the germ itself, but with just a part of the germ's genetic sequence. They've been in development since the 1990s, and they're known as DNA and RNA vaccines. And as you say, they're what Professor Heaney and others are working on. But are any DNA or RNA vaccines actually in use yet?
There hasn't yet been a DNA vaccine or an RNA vaccine that's been approved for public use. So this is still highly experimental science. Coronavirus just sort of happens to come at a moment of convergence for all these technologies. And many DNA RNA vaccines that have been developed have sort of suffered from lack of funding beyond a point when the disease seems to fade away. This happened with the original SARS epidemic.
And how long can it take to develop a vaccine?
Back in the 20th century, it could take 10, 20 years. The time has definitely shrunk now. And in particular, the first of these three phases, which is when you go from not knowing anything about what to do in terms of vaccine development for a particular germ to developing a vaccine candidate, that first third of the process has shrunk enormously.
Let's say you manage to develop a potential vaccine. How do you get to the stage where you can test that on humans?
Vaccine candidates go through animal testing first, extensive animal testing, before they're ready to go into human subjects. But what is increasingly happening with the coronavirus is that because it's such an urgent pandemic and a vaccine is so urgently needed, there are at least a couple of firms in the US that are deciding to run human and animal trials in parallel, which is why in Seattle, Moderna, this company, has started human trials already.
I was the first. Really excited about that. It was just like a flu shot. It didn't hurt. I was very happy about that.
There are usually traditionally three phases of human trials. The first one is when the vaccine is given to a small group of healthy volunteers. So you make sure that the medicine or the vaccine has no major safety issues. You can gauge initial evidence as to what kind of antibodies it's generating.
That's the stage the Oxford University coronavirus vaccine trial will soon be at. And Lydia, who we heard from at the start of this episode, is going for an initial screening test with them this week. What's the next stage?
With the second trial, it's a much larger group of people, and it usually, although not always, includes patients who have the condition that the medicine is targeting or the vaccine is targeting. The phase three trial involves, you know, hundreds, possibly thousands of people from different countries, and that demonstrates the safety and effectiveness of the vaccine in, quote-unquote, a typical patient. That's where you confirm what kind of dosage is given to a person. You see how the person reacts if the disease is still out there in the general population. So you allow them to go out into the real world and experience coronavirus as it's transmitted, and then they come back in for further testing. That may last, you know, months, maybe even a year or more, I mean, even at the fastest.
Getting to that human trial stage is a big achievement, but even then, it doesn't guarantee that vaccines or drugs will ever actually make it to market, does it?
Not at all. I mean, at least in the US, the figure is that more than 90% of the drugs that make it to human trials, to clinical trials, don't go on to market at all. I mean, there's human physiology is so complicated. I mean, however much you test a drug or a vaccine on a mouse or a ferret or a rabbit, testing it in humans is a completely different ballgame. Everybody's worst collective nightmare in the vaccine industry is that a vaccine will go out there poorly tested and will then have harmful effects on the people who it's meant to protect. And so there's layers upon layers of safety and security built into these clinical trials.
Have there been some quite high-profile cases of human trials not succeeding with very detrimental effects?
You know, the history of vaccines has several sort of red signal mishaps that still speak to vaccine scientists today. I remember reading about one yellow fever vaccine that in 1942 was given to more than 300,000 American troops. Nearly 150 of them died. And it was found out later that it was because the vaccine was contaminated with a hepatitis B virus. In 1955, there was a manufacturer named Qatar Laboratories that failed to properly deactivate the virus in its polio vaccine. And this faulty vaccine caused 40,000 cases of polio. It paralyzed 260 people. So these are all nightmarish episodes from the vaccine industry's history. And so people are very careful about trials.
This this virus is raging across so many countries now. What are the challenges to developing a vaccine in these conditions?
Well, one of the peak challenges is, I think, about when to conduct clinical trials. If the peak of the disease, the peak of the infection, by which I mean the most number of people in the population have or carry the coronavirus, if you start clinical trials then, it's impossible or it's very difficult to do it right, because what you have to do is you have to keep screening your volunteers to ensure that you don't have coronavirus, that you can then be a candidate for study. But of course, at the peak of the infection, by the time you get their screening results back, these people would have gone out into the real world again and might have been exposed to the virus. So that's sort of a problem with a peak that arrives too early. Organizing trials after the peak is another problem altogether, because so many people in the general population would have contracted a natural immunity to the disease by then, that testing a vaccine on them sort of feels redundant or almost challenging. And transmission will have dropped also. So if you immunize somebody and they go out into the general population, it's difficult to know how much they're being exposed to the virus, if at all. So all of these problems of timing are sort of really urgent at the moment. And the best possible scenario for all these candidates, it involves sort of pushing the pandemic's peak a little further into the future, maybe towards August or September, so that scientists have some time to run these trials over the summer before the peak hits in early autumn.
After this, Samanth reveals how scientists around the world are working together to create a vaccine faster than they ever have before. But first, I wanted to thank all of you for your support. In times of global crisis, trusted news is more important than ever, and The Guardian is committed to accurate, reliable news. You can help us to provide the quality information the world needs by supporting The Guardian. Just go to www.theguardian.com/support podcasts. Thank you. Once these vaccine trials have finished and they've gathered the evidence, the scientists will begin to be able to tell whether the drug has been effective. It's a long process. And even then, drugs manufacturers can't start making a vaccine. It has to go through lots of regulation before it's approved for public use. Sometimes that means doing more tests, collecting even more data. Samanth, with so much time and effort and money going into developing a coronavirus vaccine by teams across the world, is there a lot of competition between them?
I wouldn't call it competition. I mean, I think it's easy to read these headlines about the race to develop a vaccine and think that it's a winner-take-all sort of situation, but that's not the case in any way. The first vaccine candidate to come to clinical trials does not at all have to be the first vaccine candidate to make it to market. As Jonathan Heaney told me, there's a graveyard full of failed vaccine candidates. And so everybody knows that doing this kind of work and bringing a vaccine to market is an enormously complex task. I think, you know, everybody is just trying to approach the problem in their own unique way and to see what works.
Is that particularly the case with something like coronavirus? I imagine there's a lot of collegiate work going on between teams around the world.
I think so. I mean, labs around the world sort of collaborate with each other. I mean, I know Jonathan Heaney, for example, flew down to Australia halfway through February to make sure that he could see how the virus behaved in a lab that had cultured the virus for the first time outside China.
This is a huge global effort, and we're having teleconferences daily on the state of the situation, the transmission dynamics, and really trying to get as much information from the epidemic that will help us develop the very best vaccine as quickly as possible.
Eventually, at some point, if he wants to test the vaccine on a ferret and he needs a virus, you know, he might turn to the Australian lab to supply him with a culture. Collegial might not quite be the word for it, but it's definitely professional.
Okay, that's between scientists. But is there competition between political leaders in different countries to be the first to have a coronavirus vaccine? Donald Trump has spoken about how keen he is to make the process as quick as possible.
This is one of the fastest vaccine development launches in history. And I've directed the FDA to eliminate outdated rules and bureaucracy so this work can proceed rapidly, quickly, and I mean, fast.
I think that is sort of uniquely Trumpian thing. at a time when otherwise all these countries are quite collaborative about fighting the disease. The nodal organization in all of this, which I mentioned in my piece, is CEPI, which was set up a couple of years ago, you know, as a collaboration between philanthropies and nonprofits and governments to fund the research of vaccines. And CEPI continues to get international funding today in the thick of the epidemic. And so I think that is sort of more illustrative of the kind of work that happens between countries and governments.
But is there big money to be made in being the first to develop a pioneering vaccine?
Not always. It's only with a few vaccines that you can sort of make a significant amount of money if you're a drug company. I mean, what has to happen for that? It has to be a vaccine that has to immunize as many people as possible, a global disease. In many countries, there are price caps on vaccines, and so you need to be able to price it at a cost that gives you a certain amount of margin on that vaccine. It has to be the kind of product that isn't easily manufactured elsewhere in the world, so it can't be too generic. Otherwise, you know, companies in India and China and other countries will manufacture low-cost versions of the vaccine, and that would be the end of your monopoly on that. To the layman, especially during a pandemic, these look like fairly selfish measures. But that's the way in which a company might hope to make money on a vaccine.
And is there a possibility that there could be a shortage of this vaccine and that some countries might struggle more than others to get hold of it?
There's definitely a possibility of a shortage. There's a possibility of the vaccine being priced out of markets that can't afford it. There's a possibility that if it's manufactured in the US, for example, the US will then make sure that doses are only available to its own population first and foremost. Vaccines are no more immune, no pun intended, to geopolitics than any other field.
Let's imagine then that a vaccine is developed. It goes through this whole process of being created in the labs, tested on humans, and it makes it to market. It goes into production and it's available to us. And hopefully a coronavirus vaccine will be in 18 months. But by then, will it still be useful? Will the virus still be an urgent worldwide problem?
Well, there's simply no way to know right now. I mean, we don't know the dynamics of this disease in any way. We don't know whether it will hang around in the population and come back, you know, seasonally or every 2 years. We don't know whether it'll continue to afflict the old, even as the young are immune to it. We don't know if the virus will mutate and there will be a form of this COVID-19 disease out there again.
I predict, looking at the rapid spread of this, we are going to still need a vaccine in 18 months or even a year or two from now. This problem is not going to go away. We're trying to understand about viral persistence, understand the asymptomatic carrier state.
There's so much that is unknown because I think we've gone through these first few weeks of vaccine development so fast that I think a lot of us imagine that we know a lot more about the disease than is actually known. And the truth is we don't. We barely even figured out what kind of model predicts its spread over the next few weeks or what sort of measures will contain it for the moment. We're still struggling to deal with that. This is the kind of thing that we will only be able to ascertain in the long term. Over the next 3 or 4 or 5 years, we'll know if COVID-19 comes back into the population or whether it just fades out entirely, whether everybody develops some sort of immunity to it that makes a vaccine redundant.
It's clear then that a vaccine is not a silver bullet that will just instantly solve this problem and make coronavirus go away. Does it have to be part of a group of other measures being used to try and combat the virus?
I think so. I mean, along with general public health and safety campaigns, there has to be a continuance of this kind of social distancing that's happening right now if we have to curb it in the short term. I know there's research going on antivirals that might help. There are, of course, suggestions that a combination of malaria drugs might help alleviate the symptoms of coronavirus. That may well be, although that still has to be tested in humans. So all of these things in parallel, I think, work together in beating out a pandemic like this.
For someone like Jonathan Heaney, how does he see this playing out? You know, perhaps him or someone like him, another team may develop this vaccine. You know, they'll be hailed as heroes. And then is it just back to the day job he was doing before?
I think so. I mean, the Ebola vaccine, to take the most recent success in developing a vaccine, you know, it came out a few years ago and there was sort of a rush of news and glory for the scientists who developed it, but it all quickly fades out of sight. I think maybe with coronavirus, because of the kind of coverage this pandemic is getting and the kind of universality of its effects, I think obviously there is a huge amount of status that is involved with developing a vaccine. But I think Heaney and many others like him, they're all sort of acutely aware of the possibilities of failure and of the fact that so much is still unknown about the coronavirus that it will be near to a miracle if we can shepherd a vaccine through trials and into the market within the next year.
Samanth, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
You can find Samanth's long read about the race to find a vaccine at theguardian.com. Thanks to him and to Lydia for speaking to me. Today's episode was produced by Hannah Moore and the sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.